Somebody pass the stuffing. I need more stuffing.
Here you go, dear.
I would thank you, but I don't believe in thanking women for just doing their jobs.
You know, Uncle Bob, you don't need more stuffing. You want more stuffing. Some people are starving. They're the ones who need it.
Oh, here comes the lecture. Everyone quiet down so Rachel Madcow can tell us how the world works.
See, why do you have to stoop to name-calling? Can't we just have a conversation?
Well, you did start by attacking him. You were basically lecturing.
How was I lecturing?
Yeah, lecture away, Professor Liberal Pants.
Seriously, the first thing you did was dress Uncle Bob down for asking for more seconds.
Thirds. I was asking for thirds.
He's allowed to have more food. I cooked it.
Of course he is. I just want him to understand the consequences of our actions. Human beings can be extremely wasteful.
You think I disagree?
I don't know. Did you get rid of that gas guzzler yet?
I can't.
Why not?
You slashed the tires yesterday, remember? And you spray painted "I hate Mother Earth" on the side.
Fine. Maybe that was a bit much.
A bit? Now I can't do anything with it.
Ha! Who's the Nazi now?
Quiet down, Uncle Bob. I'll handle this.
Kids, why can't we just enjoy our...
Cousin Mark?
You made it up from Charlottesville. Well, that may be what your family dinner table sounds like tomorrow, and you know, we can laugh a little, but there are some serious questions that people have about what they should be doing, and when it comes to discussing politics, discussing social issues, some people hate that. We're going to talk about what the polling shows, because the polling is very interesting. Well, maybe it's not surprising that it's flipped a little bit this year. If you're a Republican, you're much more likely to say you can't wait to talk politics tomorrow with your family. If you are a Democrat, you are much more likely to say you do not want to talk about that. But some think you've got to talk about it. Some think at this point, we've got to at least try to discuss things on which we disagree. And in other ways, let's talk about the fact that when isms show up at your dinner table, sometimes you hear sexist comments, racist comments. Well, there's a lot of people who think it's important not to just sort of turn your head to the side and say nothing. So there's a lot to kind of sort through here. And we've already been hearing from some of our listeners. You can share your thoughts on how you're going to deal with that by calling the program 844-295-TALK. It's toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. In studio with us is Melanie Funches. She is the Director of Community Engagement for the Mental Health Association of Rochester. Melanie, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And also here is Eric Kane. He's a professor of psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Eric, welcome back to you.
It's good to be here today.
Yeah, I know that there's not just a blanket statement here, Mel, when it comes to, you know, how should we handle this? Because there's different degrees of these kinds of conversations. But let's start with a general rule. I'm already hearing from people like Sean, who writes to us and says, we have a no politics rule for holidays. Anyone who violates it gets banished to the kids' table. Whereas Ken writes to us and says, silence breeds ignorance. This notion that we should not discuss politics has to end. We are dumb enough already. So two very different views. Generally, how do you start with this?
Well, the way I start, and I've started with my family and my friends over the years, is I come from a place of humanity. A lot of times when we look at political views and we look at things, we look at people as other. You know, we look at immigrants as other, poor people as other, people of different races as other, people of different gender expression and sexual orientation as other. But if we personify people and we are able to see one another's humanity, we can have conversations about who we are as people. And a lot of times it's harder to be able to other somebody if it becomes someone that you can feel a shared humanity with.
Okay. Eric, what do you think?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I guess part of the question, and I assume the reason I'm here as a psychiatrist, is because we're really thinking about how people behave with each other and whether they're talking about something abstract or far away or something personal in the family. And I think about the polling because when I heard those figures, I thought, oh, well, obviously some people think they're winners and other people are kind of embarrassed because they're losers. You know, we had an election a year ago, and this winners and losers quality of these conversations, I think, is central to what makes them so bitter at times. It's not a conversation, it's a competition. And so, the question we're asking is, especially with our loved ones, Are we having a conversation? Are we sharing something? Are we open to ideas and disagreements, but doing this within the circle of affection? Or are we actually having a competition? And I think depending on your family, it may be one, the other, or both.
We've heard from some listeners in the last year who've talked about fraying family relationships or just even relationships that have ended. I heard from a woman who said that she has no relationship left with her father after the last election. And Melanie, you're kind of not. I mean, you've heard those kinds of stories.
We were on a show earlier this year when this thing came up, and I was really saddened because the thing that I want people to remember is that these are our family. You know, this is mom, this is dad. You know, these are your brothers and your sisters. And at the end of the day, family is incredibly important. And we love folks. And the biggest key to the people we love is loving them through the hard times, loving through disagreements. If it was all sunshine all the time, we wouldn't appreciate the rain. You know, it's like we've got to be able to be in a place where, you know, I have family members who I deeply, deeply, deeply disagree with. But when we get to that place, I have to step back and say, you know, I'll say to myself, do I love, you know, Uncle so-and-so, Cousin so-and-so? And I'll actually ask them, do you love me? And they'll say, of course I love you. So can we have like Eric says, can we have a conversation?
Not a competition.
Yeah. Not a competition. And what it does is that it takes you out of this theoretical place and lets you come into a different place where you can enter into conversation. Because if you love me, that means that you can enter into space with me and try to understand why I feel the way I feel and so me to understand why you feel the way you feel and to find some ground there.
I think that's great. I mean, just asking, do you love me? And then telling them, because I love you,
mm-hmm.
and I respect you. And I hope that you respect me, right?
I think we have to admit at times that all families don't love each other.
That's true.
And one of the things that I've seen over the years, and I remember when I was a little boy, I was probably about five, and my father wasn't very close to my mother's family in some ways. And, you know, they'd sit around the table. We'd go visit them in Brooklyn, and they'd be arguing. My father and my uncles would be arguing about the mayor in New York City. And we're talking about the 1950s here. The president of the United States. You could name it. They could find something to argue about. Now, obviously, as I got older, I learned, well, this was the coinage of their relationship because that's about what they did. But it was also clear that in some ways they didn't like each other very much, and this was the one setting where they could have it out without losing it. And have some safety. There really wasn't a lot of affection, but they obviously needed to keep the family together. There were enough rules about keeping things together. So I think we have to really understand that some of these discussions, which lead to these what seem like traumatic breakups, are built on unacknowledged grievances, families where there have been tensions for years. And you know, obviously what you'd really like to do is say, hey, how can we work through those as opposed to arguments where I have to convince you that I love the president or I hate the president or I, you know, want to vote for this person or, you know, the discussions now about men and women and office politics and office roles are terrible to have. No, they're essential to have. You know, people are fighting about these things and very often those are the surface things for, you know, things that are underneath that aren't settled and may never be settled.
And I agree with you because a lot of times if you have those things that are underlying and have been underlying for years and generations sometimes that are not dealt with, all it takes is a surface thing like, oh, you don't like my president or you don't like this. And it's just We don't want to deal with this, so we'll argue about this, but it's really not about this. It's about this other thing that your mother did to my mother back in 1947, you know, like Sophia Petrillo.
Or what you did to me when I was a kid and I couldn't stand with you, you know, a parent or an uncle or, you know, an elder sibling who might have been a bit abusive or something. And not so much that it was that far over the line, but it, you know, someone felt little versus the big or whatever.
You know, there was a soundbite on CNN the other day. They had a one of those, I think they would call them a focus group of Ohio Trump supporters. And there were like eight Trump supporters in the room. And there was a gentleman who said that every time Trump goes to Mar-a-Lago, he tries to be down there holding a sign that says Blacks for Trump, and that he is an African-American who thinks Trump is great because he's the only one fighting for the real working class. He's a small business owner. And he said to the CNN anchor, if Jesus Christ himself climbed down off the cross to come tell us Trump is actually with Russia, I would say, hold on, my Lord and Savior. I've got to go check with Trump on that. I mean, that is, and I am quoting directly, by the way, that you can find that soundbite out there. So I'm not sure that person's going to be convinced at a conversation at Thanksgiving that, you know, you're a little bit sycophantic here. But there are, I think, openings at times to listen. And one of my concerns, whether it's in the show or anywhere in life, is the bubbling that we're doing. And, you know, you hear about these people.
Bubbling? What's bubbling?
Like living in our bubbles,
oh,
you know?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Eric's right. I mean, we talk about family who have all these tensions, and maybe you're dreading Thanksgiving, and maybe what you do is maybe you have a Friendsgiving where on a Wednesday or Friday of this week, you get together with your friends, the people you actually want to spend more time with, and then on the holiday, you deal with your family. But most of the time, your friend groups are people who think similarly. With your family, maybe you think differently, and I'm with the people who don't like the tension that can come up, and sometimes it feels like there's no point, but I also don't like the bubbles that we form. So Mel, is there a utility to saying in a loving way, and I love the way you enter these conversations, you know, do you love me? You know, can we establish that there's at least love there? But is there a utility to saying this is an opening, because I'm not going to see you that often throughout the year, that you'll at least maybe understand where I'm coming from, even if you're not going to convince them?
I think so, because what happens is if you can open up a window to say, look, we're only together twice, three times a year, you know, Mother's Day, Thanksgiving, and Christmas, let's say, you know, and if that, can we have this conversation? Because even if you don't convince somebody, something that's happened, and I know what's happened within my own family, that I will drop something here, right? And we'll talk about it. And they're like, yeah, Melanie, you're just one of those, whatever, whatever. And, you know, hey, you know, you know me. But the thing is that they'll say to me, I've had cousins and people who've come to me a couple years later, said, Melanie, remember when we were at Auntie's house and you said XYZ? I said, yeah. They said, girl, I didn't get you then. I thought you was just all over to the left or whatever. But now I understand. Now, they didn't say they agree. They said they understand. And that's all we should really, that's what we should ask for people, that we should be able to understand each other. Because a lot of times I think where we mess up is we're trying to get people to necessarily agree with us.
Mm-hmm.
And we think if they don't agree with us, that they don't understand us. I can understand that I can understand that some people choose to wear polka dots and stripes together. I don't agree that it's a good fashion choice, but I understand it, and it's okay for them.
Well, some of us just try to stick with solids, you know. but, you know, one of the things that's inherent to what you're saying, right central to it, is the idea of respect.
Yes.
And so I think one of the basic rules of conversation, and I'm using that word conversation, coming together and talking, is can you be respectful even when you disagree? So your example, that really extraordinary opening that we had with that, you know, high cast of characters, some of whom we may have recognized, was striking in how quickly it became disrespectful. And there was disrespect all over the place. And so when my kids were little, I said, it's okay for you to be angry with me as long as you're not disrespectful. We all have feelings. There are times where we're going to be angry with someone else. Can we do that in a way that still shows respect, which underneath that is affection and love, and
mm-hmm.
and really seeing another person as an honorable individual, not just a slime ball? And, you know, of course, one of the things now is there's this equation. If you think this, you must be really terrible. And that presupposes too much. It's really a stereotype. There are people who disagree with me who are wonderful people, even if they do disagree with me. And
there are those people?
Yeah, yeah, there are.
Wow.
So it's a question, can we deal with each other with respect? And so I think that what you're also talking about, Evan, is can people in a family have a conversation where it's really built on a platform of respect. And one of the interesting things you see sometimes is that family members are occasionally more willing to say nasty things to their loved ones, the people they're closest to, as opposed to strangers.
Absolutely.
That they kind of, well, you know, he's always going to accept me or she's always going to love me, so I can say anything. Whereas, you know, if you met someone on the street or at a bar or at work, you wouldn't ever say that kind of thing because you might offend them or you don't know them well enough.
Because it's safe. I mean,
well, you think it is.
You think it's safe. See, yeah, we believe it's safe. Like, you know, my youngest daughter, she will have these moments where she's really anxious or whatever, and she'll just, bleh, right? She'll just, you know, she'll just go and she'll let it all rail. And it's like, and she'll do it, and I'll sit there and I'll take it, because I know what's behind it. And she actually, on her social media, she put this picture, and she says, literally, my mom supporting me in my times when I'm just really in a messed up space. And it's a picture of Beyonce sitting in an empty stadium, just cheering all by herself, right? And it's like, my mom supporting me. And so it was her way of saying, I know I did this.
So yeah. Evan picked up on that in a way which I'm not sure he exactly meant, but you see parents and children who love each other but are not friends.
Yes.
And you see parents and children who are friends. And, you know, you were saying, well, I'm, you know, maybe on Wednesday and Friday, some people go hang out with their friends and then they do their duty on Thursday. And so
I know there's people who feel that way.
Well, I wasn't arguing the point. I was just saying that's sort of like saying, well, you know, my family are yeah, I might love them, but I have to tolerate them and they're not my friends. And so one of the conversation questions is, can you have a conversation with your family as if they're your friends, in such a way that, of course, you respect your friends. You feel like you want to guard your friends' feelings.
Yes.
In such a way that they aren't hurt when you have the interchange. And do you guard your family's feelings? And I think that's a really important question for people to ask. And what's the line over which, if I go beyond that, I'm not guarding anymore, I'm just dumping?
I keep going back to what Melanie talked about with you know, that moment where a family member, you know, maybe years later would say, you know, you had this moment where I thought you were off the rails, but I realize now, you know, at least I understand you. And then you clarified, not necessarily agreed with you, but I think just observing how, you know, I have very few skills in life, but I can say that having done this talk show for 500 hours a year, I get a good sense for what might change minds or at least open minds. And what Melanie is describing is the first step toward humanizing someone, because before anyone is going to agree with your position if they currently disagree, the first thing they've got to do is view you in human terms and be able to articulate your position in a way that you would agree with. So if Eric is my uncle and I were to say, Eric, you supported Barack Obama because you love socialism and you want people, you know, to have no freedom, correct? And you would say, no, of course not. You know, and I'd say, well, that's my interpretation. So, you know, talk to you next Thanksgiving. If I can say you supported Barack Obama because, you know, you viewed his way of approaching politics as the most egalitarian, the best way of fostering economic opportunity without taking away from those who want to innovate and have ideas. And if I disagree with it, at least that was your approach. You would say, okay, fair. Now we can start from somewhere. And then I can say, well, I supported Mitt Romney. And again, this is all hypothetical. You know, can you explain why I voted this way? Can you explain why I support this? Can you explain why I've got a problem with people kneeling during the anthem? And can you explain why I support people kneeling during the anthem? Can we articulate properly the person's viewpoint in a way that they would agree with? That's the first step, I think, in humanizing them.
Well,
and that's exactly what
actually, I would go a little earlier, and I would say, can you listen to them without having your own ideas so intrude that you don't hear what they're saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so the first part of understanding is actually listening and setting aside your own, or at least holding in abeyance, your own thoughts, views, and other things so you can appreciate what someone is saying. Now, if someone attacks you and you start thinking, what a jerk this person is, or other words you might use to describe somebody who's, you know, stereotyping you or taking you in a direction which you don't think you fit, then it's really hard to listen. So listening is essential for understanding. And listening in a way means that you've are willing to hold your own thoughts just long enough in a, I don't want to call it a cocoon or compartment, but so you can hear what someone else says without blocking your ears.
Absolutely. It's like here about when we seek to listen to understand instead of listening to respond. You know, a lot of times, and my family hears me do this and they laugh at me, because a lot of times I'll say, what I heard in what you said was, and then go into what...
Sounds like a mental health professional.
You know, and I'll say this, I say it with my family, and they laugh at me, but they're like, but at the same time, they're like, Melanie, you are really good at capturing what people are feeling, what people are really saying. And I'm like, because I'm seeking to do what you say, to listen to, for understanding. Because a lot of times the arguments that we have at Thanksgiving is because people don't feel heard.
Yeah, there's a comedian named Brian Regan who does a bit on what he calls the me monster. And everybody knows the me monster. You have dinner with someone and every story is about themselves. And then if you are talking, they are teeing up in their own brain a way to top your story. And when it comes to politics, they tend not to be setting aside their own thoughts in a cocoon or just taking for a moment just to listen and receive it. They are immediately thinking, how am I going to counter this and knock it down? Beware the me monster at Thanksgiving. And maybe we all should try not to be the me monster, maybe to listen a little bit more. After our break, I'm going to start going through some of your feedback here. We've got a lot of comments coming into us via email and Twitter, and we'll open it up to you. What's your approach to working through Thanksgiving, dealing with family, talking about politics? It's 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And we will also address something that hasn't come up yet, which is tied to all of this, which is, it's one thing when you hear political ideas you don't like, or I supported this candidate, you know, Uncle Bob supported this candidate, I don't like it, I don't want to talk about it, or I want to talk about it. It's another when you hear someone in your family say something that is racist or sexist. And it's a question of, what are we going to do with that? We're going to talk about that and a lot more when we come back. Coming up in our second hour, New York State has helped resettle more refugees than almost any other state. And when you see some of the disparities, it's shocking. States like Delaware have accepted zero refugees in the last year. New York is one of three that has handled more than a quarter of the thousands of refugees coming to our states. And so how can we help them this time of year? We explore that next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Melanie Funches is Director of Community Engagement for the Mental Health Association of Rochester, and Eric Kane is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center. We're talking about Thanksgiving, politics, and all of the tensions that can come up in those settings. First email, and a person asked to withhold their name. She says, great discussion. The guests are giving great advice for people that are intentional about sustaining positive relationships, but not everyone is that evolved. Can you please address how to handle those folks that are so wounded that they are willing to slash and burn their way through family gatherings?
Rope-a-dope. Mm-hmm. Now, Muhammad Ali was in an amazing fight with George Foreman in Zaire. And, you know, Foreman, who, of course, was in some ways a more formidable, stronger person. But Ali ended up winning the fight by not punching back until Foreman was all tired out and had arm fatigue. So one of the things that you do in a situation where someone's being very aggressive is you just let him aggress. Because if you don't need to be defensive other than just sort of being there, then most people eventually run out of steam. And you don't necessarily have to say anything either, because the point is not to win the contest. And if someone is, as I say, aggressive, but, you know, it's around a family table and that sort of thing, and they get their say and everybody just sort of lets it land like a thud, or in Ollie's case, he had his arms up in front of him and landed on his arms, then, you know, things can go on afterwards, and you can enjoy the pumpkin pie for dessert. So that's the kind of thing I've done when I've thought that someone is never going to hear what I have to say and is never going to respond in any way other than being a jerk. And, you know, that's a technical term in the diagnostic and statistical manual.
Yes. And I agree with you, Eric. It's like the monsters that grow are the monsters you feed. And if you don't feed it, it doesn't grow. And so what happens is I've been in that place where I've done the rope-a-dope. And that's why I laughed when I heard you say it, and that, like, the thing keeps landing and it gets no air. And but it, a part of that is having an understanding among other people, you know, saying, look, this is how we're going to get down with this. When Uncle Bobby comes and he's starting to do the thing that he does, we're going to do the rope-a-dope, you know, and we're going to let it land like a lead balloon every time, no matter what, you know. And if, you know, something's going on, you know, we're going to give an eye signal, whatever it is, and he and it'll run out of steam, you know. And
offer him more turkey.
Yeah. Would you like some cranberry sauce?
But I like it because a lot of people in that position think that they're going to get engaged. And they think that I'm yes. setting up a fight here. And if they just ramble and then all of a sudden everyone is just kind of quietly eating, saying nothing back, I don't know. Maybe that takes away the fuel for that kind of a fire.
Well, it's basically the idea of saying, I'm not going to get engaged with you. I'm not going to get in a battle with you, because that's all it is a battle.
Let me grab our first phone call. It's Brittany in Rochester. Go ahead, Brittany.
Hi, Evan. I just wanted to call and say I really appreciate the conversation you guys are having. And on top of that, kind of the concept of not just hearing what people are saying, but not listening and hearing, and kind of the difference between the two. And also my question is the importance in these conversations of I statements, so kind of how you're feeling, and not making these broad generalizations that we tend to make whenever talking about politics.
Yeah, thanks, Brittany. It's an interesting idea there. And, you know, sometimes we do. I appreciate the phone call, Brittany. Sometimes we do overgeneralize or just assume that our experience is everyone's experience. Context is good to keep in mind there. And our guests are helping us with that. Eric Kane and Melanie Funchess are leading us through how we might approach our families and these kind of conversations.
Well, and the I statement, without just saying I did it or didn't do this or I saw this or didn't see this, specificity is really important. We get in a lot of trouble when we make sweeping comments about groups of people, populations, characteristics. You know, the less you do a stereotype and the more you talk about yesterday this happened to me or today this happened to me, or I saw something on TV and this is how I responded. And that's the I statement part. But as you're more specific, then you can at least be also open to being accountable to how you feel. And you, again, so if someone listens to you, then you can begin to have a conversation. Generalizations are the pitfall for, you know, you call them the isms, but generalizations are the thing that get people in a lot of trouble.
Absolutely.
All right. So Vanessa on Twitter says, I did research on methods to counteract misinformation for my thesis. There's a three-step method I plan on trying for science. So I'm hoping all topics are on the table. And she says,
turkey science.
And she says, this is not my method. It's based on a different study in media literacy. She says, number one, I use information that would relate to or align with their beliefs. Number two, I would make them examine their sources. And number three, stay on topic. And then, of course, number four is pie.
Absolutely pie.
Pie is key.
Whipped cream, gravy, whatever part of the meal you're in, you know, it's how do you sweeten the pot.
Pie is key to this. Robert says the following, though. He says, while I'm all for civil and constructive conversation, lines in the sand have to be drawn somewhere, and I feel we've reached that point. Trump said he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and not lose votes. What was once hyperbolic is now more and more actual truth. There is no more understanding and compromise. It's a with us or against us mentality now. And I'm sorry, but if you support Trump, there is no compromise, because his very nature is uncompromising. It's a sad day for democracy, and happy Thanksgiving.
Well, let me sort of comment to that in this way. The way I would, again, deal with that is around the specific, not the general. You know, if we said that someone murdered someone, you know, homicide, then, you know, the thing that I would invoke is law and order, you know, in the sense that, you know, someone has to be accountable for their action. If you've brought up the question of difficult things said in a meal that are racist or bigoted or other things, and in those situations where I've had to face it sometime in my life, I've said, you know, my experience doesn't coincide with what you've just said. In fact, I've had the opposite experience. Let me tell you about it. And again, very specific, uncompromisingly direct, but not where I'm talking about this person saying, you know, you're a racist so-and-so, or your...
It may be what you want to say.
You know, let's put it this way. The thought went through my mind. but the idea is to immediately draw on your own experience or what you know. If someone shoots someone in public, they may make the proclamation that I'm not going to be prosecuted, but that the law will hold you accountable just as it would anyone else. And so I think there are ways to begin to open into this kind of thing. If someone lies or someone, you know, says one thing in public one time and another thing in the public another time, and they're totally contradictory and not someone's not accountable, you can say, well, look, on such and such a date, someone said this, and, you know, 10 days later, he said that. How do we make sense of that? How do we understand that these two things are absolutely contradictory? You know, but first, this goes back to the person who says, start with the facts.
All right. I see the phone ringing, and I'm going to get Kathy in Rochester, who runs workshops for a group called Surge, Showing Up for Racial Justice, on how white people can respond to racist comments. I want to hear from Melanie, and I'm going to read a comment from a listener first, and Melanie Funches tee this up, how can we respond to racist and sexist comments. Chris writes this, using social media. Chris Thompson writes, on behalf of black folk, he says, dear white folks, instead of arguing with your family during Thanksgiving dinner, simply play one of these great documentaries in the background. I Am Not Your Negro, The Problem with Apu, The 13th Amendment, and Get Out. Love black folk. So he said, drive them nuts with that, is what Chris
says. I am here for it. It's like... I've done something similar to what Eric talks about, and I speak from my own experience. I remember a time, it wasn't a Thanksgiving, I was invited to a friend's house for dinner, and I had met my friend's mother over the phone several times, and we had had conversations and talked. For whatever reason, it never came up that I was black. It never came up. I don't know how it didn't come up. You know, this was many years ago before I married my husband. My name, my maiden name, my first name does not, I guess it doesn't scream black out loud. But I showed up to the house about 15 minutes early. My friend was supposed to meet me and walk me back to the house. And I said, I got there a little early, so I decided to walk to the house. I walked to the house. They said, oh, he's not home. And I left, walking back to where I was supposed to meet him. We cross up. We're coming back to the house. And when he came in first, I was like two steps behind him. He said, his mother said, hey, some N came here looking for you. Mm. And I was like, oh, my. Because he didn't know how to handle the situation. And so I stepped in and said, hey, I'm Melanie. And she was so shocked because she had a mental picture of who I was, mm-hmm. that she didn't even know how to do it. So, and I sat right there because I felt in that time, now I was much younger and didn't have the traumas I have now. So I may not have done this in this way now, but I sat there and made her be present, you know, and I said, let's do this. And I've had different times, but I use my own life experience. Like, I've had conversations with my white friends, and I say, well, Melanie, you know, I hear what, you know, black women are saying about this or that, and I just don't understand that it can happen. And one of the things was about hair. And I told a story how I was in a local cosmetic shop, and a woman was insistent on touching my hair. And she backed me into a display where I had nowhere else to go. And finally, I had to put my hand out and say, stop. You know, because she felt the need to be able to touch my person. And she said, well, why would anybody do that? And I said, but this is why when we tell you things, but they couldn't understand it in the abstract. But when I told them that me as an individual, their friend, had experienced the very thing they were saying, they couldn't believe that it actually happened. It changed the way they saw it. And maybe this is possible. And they started looking more. So when we, you know, if what I would say to my white friends is that if you're at the table and people are saying things, be it racist, be it sexist, be it homophobic, be it xenophobic, whatever it is, if you have a way to attach, you know, to personalize that thing and make it and bring yourself into that space to be present with them around their comment, step into that space. What's the worst that can happen? You don't get a seconds of potatoes? You know, I mean, people say, well, people will whatever. They will lose their relationships. Probably not. Not for that one thing. It'll be if it's like we talked about earlier, some underlying thing. But walk up to it. But there's ways that you can respectfully and would love, lovingly walk up to it and say, nah, boo, you know, this, we're not doing this.
So a lot of these things are tied to perceived stigma. You know, so you know, when you're racist, you're stigmatizing another group. When you're religiously bigoted, you're stigmatizing another group. When you're homophobic. And so one of the fundamental questions that a person sitting there, you know, as it were, a witness to this, has to ask is, what do I do when a stigma comes up in a situation? Mm-hmm. How do I respond to that? And, you know, I'm sort of being very concrete. One of the most important things is not to be uncomfortable with the topic, not to be uncomfortable about your thoughts about race or religion or
Absolutely.
Or sexual identity or gender identity or those sorts of things or preferences, and to be able to say, look, you know, my experience has been whatever. You know, I've got, you know, I meet every Saturday morning with a friend who's truly African American because he's from Africa, African American, you know, and we're family, you know, that's a truth of my life. So the idea of your, again, how do you make things personal? How do you bring them into the circle of the family? How do you bring them into the conversation, not as a competition and not as a judgment? Because the other thing you're trying to do is remove judgment. You're trying to take the fangs of judgment because, you know, the stigma comes with judgment. And racism and sexism and all these things come with judgment. And you're trying to pull those fangs out without actually hurting. Because if you hurt, then they won't hear you.
So can I ask both of you then, because what you're describing is getting away from the general, you know, going back to Brittany's phone call, talking about specifics. Because I suspect a lot of people who engage in these isms or have these beliefs don't have a lot of experience with someone who is gay, trans, black, whatever the case may be, right? So does that help counter, because their generalizations may come from sort of media stereotypes, whatever sort of fever dreams that they have about the way the world is, yeah. And without a lot of direct experience, what you're saying is, personal experience will show you.
Right.
Break down this wall.
And this is true, you know, when people were opposed to the military. You know, you had a lot of people on the left, and, you know, I grew up during the Vietnam War era. Well, all soldiers must be bad. You know, they're baby killers. This was true, you know, well, everybody who's a conservative, you know, from the left would be, well, they're just a rich person who wants to take advantage. And from the right, it's, well, you know, all those people who happen to be on Medicaid right now, they're just sponging off the state. You know, these are stories without actual true listening and understanding about what people are going through in their life.
Hmm. Let's grab a phone call from Kathy, who runs a workshop for Surge. Why don't you tell us about it, Kathy?
Hi, and thank you so much for this conversation, and thank you, Melanie, for your wisdom. Melanie is an advisor to our group. It's called Surge Rock. It's a part of the national effort called Showing Up for Racial Justice. And it really is aimed at helping white people to get the skills that you're talking about. So we've been running ongoing workshops that deal with mostly racist comments, but other things come up as well. And what we're doing is accumulating effective responses. And everything you've said here is what we have come to realize, because Surge has a value for calling people in and not out. So we, as allies, realize that if we're pushing people away, we're pushing other white people away, then we're not being good allies. So we have a process that we do, and we invite your listeners to go to our website. It's surgerock.org, and it's a role play. We do a lot of testing out things. We think together, we feel together, because we realize that what happens is that white people don't have words. We didn't grow up talking about what it meant to be a white person in a racist society. We don't know how to talk to each other. So what we're doing here is practicing how to just talk and how to feel. And I just wanted to share that with you.
And Kathy, it's surgerock.org, S-U-R-J, right? That's Showing Up for Racial
That's
Justice?
Right. Showing Up for Racial Justice.
S-U-R-J-rock.org. Thank you, Kathy. Mel, you want to add to that?
Well, thank you, Kathy. What I want to say is that everything that we're talking about is about relationship. You know, whatever it may be, by blood, by if it's your family of blood, your family of choice, however this falls out, it's about being in relationship with people and being able to learn how to have words. Because like Kathy said, many white people do not have words for this. Because if you're living in I'm talking about specifically around a lot of the racial stuff, is around if white, and white has been default, you know, since forever. And it's the norm and everything else is away from center. If you're in the default, it's like Dory, you know, you're in the water and you're just swimming. You know, you don't know, you don't see the water around you. It's just there. And so now we're having to be able to identify the water.
I want to add another perspective to this. I'll say this as a male who's white, so I'm privileged.
Yes, you are.
Yes, I know. And yet, on the other hand, I've also been the object of stereotype. So when I took on a leadership position many years ago, I had some women say, well, you'll never have women leaders in your department, which turned out to be sort of 180 degrees from what happened. And I've been, you know, accused, without anybody knowing me, of potentially being racist until someone knows me. So, you know, the other side of it is that you have to be comfortable enough with yourself so that if someone is making presumptions about you, and I've had black people make presumptions about me in terms of what I might or might not think based on that, then that you have to be comfortable enough, again, to listen, to hear, to try to understand people's experience and not necessarily be defensive. And this goes back to, how do you have a conversation around the dinner table? You know, the idea of not having to react and respond right away when you're accused of something. So, Evan, you suggested that I voted for Barack Obama for a set of reasons.
It was all hypothetical.
I know it was hypothetical. But, you know, I was sitting over here at the microphone. I didn't immediately jump up across the table and grab you by the shirt and say, well, you don't know what you're talking about. I let you come up with the second hypothetical. But the idea of not being reactive is critical to being able to have a conversation, because even when you're being specific, someone may lay a stereotype on you one way or the other and assume one thing or the other, which is what we saw in your opening, you know, your opening gambit there. And people immediately responded to those stereotypes as opposed to saying, well, wait a minute, you need to get to know me. How will you do that? Can we take the time to get to know each other? And just because you're in family doesn't mean you know each other.
That's a great point.
That's a great point. You know, because there's times when, you know, I have cousins who they will say things about my mom. My mom has passed on. And they would say things, well, Auntie Yvonne, this, this, and that. And I'm like, whose auntie were you talking about? That's not my mom. And because they only saw this one piece of who she was.
And you don't want to mess with Melanie too much.
I am kind and sweet and gentle. But, you know, we've got to be, you know, be comfortable in your own skin. Part of the ability to step into that space and be present with others in those difficult conversations is first you being comfortable in your own skin, being comfortable with the positions that you hold and the things that you hold true as your belief system. If you're comfortable with those things, it can give you some sense of, I don't want to say like protection, but it can give you it has you move into the space differently, because people have said things about me that I know aren't true. And it's like, well, Melanie, aren't you angry? I said, no. I said, why? Because it's not true.
Right. So this gets at we were talking about before, not being reactive or being able to hold your thoughts so you can listen to someone else without having them, your own thoughts, as it were, clog your ears. Mm. And so what, you know, Melanie's saying is, hey, I don't have to react to that.
No.
I want to get through one more phone call and then a really important email. But let me just kind of close the loop on this, and I'll just ask Mel briefly here. At the very least, I think it's probably a good thing to resolve that if we do hear, even people we do love, say things that are in those isms, in some fashion, probably at least respond in some way.
Absolutely.
Not let it just thud, not let it sort of get laughter and move on.
Right. You know, you can say, really, why do you feel that way? Mm-hmm. You know, and be curious. And then when you're being curious, people, you can learn where someone gets something from, and you may be able to inject some other information to broaden their understanding. And it may move them, it may not. But, you know, you can do that, but don't laugh and keep moving, because your laughter is like a scent. It's like, you know, people will say, oh, yeah, this is great, and it'll happen again. So, no.
Okay.
Deal with that.
Carol next on the phone. Go ahead, Carol.
Yeah. I'm in the middle of making cranberry relish.
Yay!
But, last Thanksgiving, we had two kids. They live in Pennsylvania, and they were coming for Thanksgiving and staying here, and they refused. They said, we're not staying in the same house. We're not staying together in your house, they said. So I kind of tricked them into kind of being here at the same time the day before Thanksgiving, and I said, you're going into the living room, you're going to close the door, you're going to shout, you're going to cry, you're going to scream, you can call each other names, but when you come out, you're going to have Thanksgiving dinner with us. And
go, Mom.
I mean, it didn't solve their problem, but at least we were able to have a nice Thanksgiving.
Well, I'm heartened to hear that you at least got through the Thanksgiving, and it was nice enough, and you're doing it again, huh?
I hope not. No, I don't think so. I think we've calmed down.
Well, they're coming back, that is.
They are coming back. Are.
Yes.
So you have moral authority over them. You had some persuasive ability because you
have moral authority over the Thanksgiving table.
Well, but also over them.
Yeah.
Because you had enough authority to say, you're going in that room and I'm going to hold you accountable. And that's not like a club, but that is like a requirement. If you're going to deal with me, you have to deal with each other.
And so, it's okay to set some rules, right?
Exactly.
When it's your house,
absolutely.
As Carol says, right?
And, you know, and use the cards that you're dealt and use them to work and play them to work. I mean, you know, you pulled the mom card. You know, it's like someone sent me a picture of two kids. Every time they fight, they have the shirt, and it's this giant T-shirt that they make the two kids get in together, and they have to hug it out. You know, and they have to be in that close proximity until they work out what their issue is. And, you know, you said no. You know, I love you both. You guys are going to do this, and you use the cards you were dealt, and you got through it.
And in the best situation, parents do help set the values of a family.
Absolutely.
And that was a values action.
Thank you, Carol, for that. Real quick, Heidi
says,
Heidi says, we're all probably forgetting the role that alcohol plays in the holiday for bad behavior. I mean, that's an important point, isn't it, Eric?
Sure. And people, you know, lose their thoughtfulness, their consideration. They become more reactive. And clearly, especially if you've had experience over the years and you know that some are more prone to it than others, then you really need to have a conversation, perhaps even before you have the first drink.
Absolutely.
Which, again, can be awkward, but still valuable, right?
But it's part of the family values.
And you may decide that, you know, alcohol comes with dessert. You know, you may not have alcohol during the main meal. You may have alcohol with dessert. I mean, there's ways you can do this. You know, in our family, in our house, we don't drink alcohol with the main. We don't drink alcohol during dinner. We just don't. You know, I'm a Pentecostal preacher's kid, so we don't. But we will have, during dessert and after, you know, people can drink wine or drink whatever. But if the main meal is over, and then that people's stomachs are full, so it has food to absorb the alcohol, and it has, you know, you can do things. But I'm saying that to say that there's things we can do to try and maybe mitigate that a little bit.
All right. Well, here's Mike sending an email to help us close the hour. He says, on this day when we remember President Kennedy, there is a famous quote that he directed toward the Soviet Union, which can be applied to family differences as well. He said, quote, for in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's future, and we are all mortal, end quote. And Mike says, as we enter the holiday season, we should reflect upon those words. It puts things in perspective. Thank you, Mike. And thank you to Melanie Funchess, who is Director of Community Engagement for the Mental Health Association of Rochester. Happy Thanksgiving to you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And Eric Kane, happy Thanksgiving to this professor of psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Thank you, Eric. Always good.
It's always good to be here.
All right. Short break. And we're talking about ways that you can help refugees in our community next hour. Stay with us.